By now, it is a familiar story. All across the country, books are getting banned from school classrooms or pulled from library shelves.
Around the country, efforts to ban specific books or even whole categories of books.
We have reached the inevitable book banning purge list portion of the
right-wing education. A group challenged these books, saying that they contain inappropriate material for students. Now the district has formed a committee to review the books and recommend.
There's a range of claims about these books, that they'll make white kids feel bad about themselves or guilty, even that they're pornographic.
Does equity and inclusion also include incestuous relationships?
Between last July and this March, there were book bans in 86 school districts across 26 states, according to a report from PEN America. It defines bans as any instance where a book's either been made harder to access or removed entirely. Over 1,100 different books were challenged. Pennsylvania was not immune. In this two-part episode, we're visiting two school districts with two very different book ban stories, Central York and Central Bucks. Now, the fact that both of these districts have Central in their name is kind of telling. Both are suburban districts, the kind where people of different races and religions and political persuasions mix. And they are, in their own ways, microcosms of America. Right now, both are at the center of a very American fight over who belongs. This is Schooled. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In the first of these two episodes, we're taking you to the Central York School District. It's actually just outside the city of York, which is in south central Pennsylvania, right near the Maryland border. It's one of those places that's diversifying fast. A decade ago, about 24% of Central York students were students of color. Today, it's 36%. And amid that shift, Central York recently found itself in the national spotlight. One note before we begin, this episode does contain references to sexual assault. Reporter Mallory Falk takes it from here.
Let's start this story on a quiet cul-de-sac where a woman named Erica Bowie lives with her two daughters and their trusty guard dog, an elderly Shih Tzu.
His name is Buster, and our old man will be 14 in September. He's partially blind and deaf. He's always going to bark when someone comes in the house, so that still works.
Erica moved to Central York from Baltimore, where she still works as an auditor. It's a pretty common story here. Over the past decade or so, lots of families have moved here from bigger cities. It's kind of a crossroads of America, with urban, rural, and suburban districts all in one county.
We moved here for the resources. The schools were better. It was less populated. We could move slower. The cost of living was like so different and so much cheaper. Nothing that I experienced.
She felt like her kids were in good hands when they started at the Central York School District. Then one day last September, she got a call from her grandmother.
And she was like, "Hey, what's going on up there in York, Pennsylvania?" I was like, I don't know. And she was like, "Well, apparently you can't read any books by any black people." And I was like, "I don't think that's true." So I cut the TV on and it's on there.
In York County, students at Central York High School holding a protest this morning in response to the school district banning materials by black and Latino authors that discuss race in America.
That list includes a children's book about Rosa Parks, Lala Yousafzai's autobiography, CNN's Sesame Street Town Hall on racism.
Racism? What's that?
And much, much more.
Okay, so what actually happened? Why had the national media descended on this sleepy suburban district in central Pennsylvania? Back in 2020, after the police killing of George Floyd and nationwide protests for racial justice, the district's diversity committee got together. They came up with a list of resources teachers could use to help students process what was happening. It included hundreds of books and other materials like documentaries. But then the school board stepped in and barred teachers from using those resources. They said they'd received complaints from parents and wanted to review everything on the list before they'd approve it. But that review process never happened. By the following school year, fall of 2021, the list was still frozen. This all happened pretty quietly. That is, until the high school principal sent out an email at the start of the school year, reminding teachers not to use the banned materials. A local paper, the York Dispatch, picked up the story. That's how a lot of people found out. Like Renee Ellis, a junior at Central York High School.
They don't say that it's directly targeting people of color and authors of color, but when you look at the resources that they banned, it's pretty evident.
Scrolling through the list, she saw a couple books that had meant a lot to her back in middle school. Some of the first ones she'd read with Black characters at the center, like The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas.
They helped me to feel less alone in a school where I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me. So those books were just, they felt safe in a way. This sounds weird in a book, but when you find something that you can relate to and that you can connect to, it makes you feel a little less alone in a world that's kind of against you in a way.
Seeing them on the list,
it just hurt because I knew how important they were to me and I knew they could be important to someone else as well.
Parent Erica Bowie had a similar reaction. She saw the list included children's picture books about a little Black girl who loves science and another who loves styling her hair. She thought about her younger daughter, a second grader at the time.
It denies my daughter a sense of belonging. To me, it's saying you don't belong. To me, my daughter gets the message that you don't belong here, but we tolerate you.
And she thought about that decision to move to Central York about a decade ago.
So it's kind of like, so you moved out here for the resources that aren't even including you.
Renee would end up helping organize protests against the ban every morning outside the high school for weeks. They would grow and gain attention with people like Erica joining in. And eventually, the school board reversed the ban.
Made an impact and it was good. And I'm glad that it was reversed. We were all really excited.
It's a little unusual to tell you how this story ends at the beginning. Normally, we'd start with that moment when news of the book ban spread and build momentum and tension as we followed the fight against it. Maybe end with the scene when a couple of the students testified in front of Congress during a hearing about book bans and academic censorship.
Banning books of those of minority background and unique backgrounds silences their voices and erases their history, and arguably is taking away their right to express themselves. These are words on a page that have the power to change a cold heart to warm. It's not indoctrination, it's education. Thank you.
That was Renee's older sister, Christina. But we wanted to give you something you don't normally get. All over the country right now, there are battles over books and school curriculum, about how history is taught and whose stories are included. But who are the ordinary people who take a stand as these fights play out? What compels them to get involved? And how does this experience change them?
It's really universally cosmic how them being so hateful and so outwardly just disgusting towards us and towards this book, everything, actually helped heal me.
Patricia Jackson teaches language arts and creative writing at Central York High School. Books and stories are her thing. But at first, she was a little hesitant to get involved with the student protests. Patricia grew up here in York County in what she describes as a mostly white world.
I rode horses, for goodness sake.
And for most of her life, she tried not to draw much attention to herself. It's a lesson she learned from her dad. He grew up in Alabama in the 30s and 40s. Patricia says as a kid, he witnessed a gruesome lynching, and it shaped how he moved through the world. That had an impact on her. So did growing up as a Black sci-fi nerd in a white community. She's a big Star Wars fan, even has a special drawer in her classroom with not one, not two, but three lightsabers. She jokingly waves them at students who need to settle down. But that franchise and the others she loved as a kid don't have leading Black characters.
And even if you have the token Black person in there, they're not center stage. They're the ensemble cast.
She didn't see herself represented in her community or in her favorite stories. So when she started writing fiction as a kid,
my characters were blue-eyed and fair-skinned and blonde hair because that's what the world told me was beautiful. It was not until my 20s, when I started writing Star Wars fiction, that I started to say, oh, well, this character is dark-skinned. But that's all I would say.
Then, a few years ago, she started to write what would ultimately become her first published novel. It's called Forging a Nightmare.
My book is about an FBI agent who is tracking down a serial killer who is taking out people born with 12 fingers and toes.
Early on, this secondary character came to her, a loud, proud Black woman.
Dreadlocks, the whole nine yards.
It's something that hadn't happened before. And she started to reimagine her book. The protagonist, that dogged FBI agent, should he be Black too?
And I'm like, well, he's part angelic. Are angels Black? You know, so you go through this whole litany in your mind of, but we've never seen that before. So yes, I made angels Black. And just did it proudly, and there was this freedom, and I call it my exorcism, where I came to love myself as a Black woman, because at that point, I don't think I did.
Patricia describes this process as tending to a wound that either had to start healing or start festering. And it primed her to step up when a fellow teacher asked for guidance after the resource ban. His name's Ben Hodge, and he's the faculty advisor for the Panther Anti-Racist Union, or PARU, a student group that formed in the wake of George Floyd's murder. The high school mascot is a panther. Ben said his students wanted to protest the ban and asked if Patricia could help support them. The two are close. They trust each other's judgment and bounce ideas off each other.
So he comes to me, and I don't want to be involved. I want to keep things as quiet as possible and attract no attention to myself. But I see my friend being so passionate about this, and I know they will come for him, and I cannot and will not allow that, and nor will I allow them to come for the children.
After writing a book with a leading Black character and coming to embrace her own Blackness, Patricia says she didn't want to crawl back under a rock. She wanted to support those students, to serve as a kind of protective shield as they put themselves on the line. So she got on board, and that had a ripple effect. Remember Renee Ellis, that student who was so disheartened to see some of her favorite books on the banned list? She was like Patricia, someone who kept a low profile.
I was naturally a little quieter than most people, especially in school. I don't really say much. I'm just trying to get the good grade and get out.
Her sister Christina is the extrovert with the take charge personality. She and her friends were the ones who started to talk about a protest. But Renee wasn't so sure.
I'm one of those people I like to organize my thoughts and get things in order first before I move. And that, you know, when things happen spontaneously, you don't have the opportunity to do that. So I was wanting to wait back, and then I also didn't want to cause a fuss, you know. I knew that it wasn't right, but, you know, when you're faced with a school board, you're a little intimidated.
Just a few days after learning about the ban, Christina got on a Zoom with other members of PARU, along with Patricia and Ben. Renee kind of lurked in the background.
And I was listening to them talk. I was like, you know, I have a couple ideas, you know, raising one finger. And they were like, okay. And Miss Jackson told me, I was like, is it okay if I be a part of the group? And she was like, listen, we're going to do this. It's going to move. You're drafted. Let's go. And so ever since then, I kind of just been on the train and we've been moving. It's just been growing as a group.
This teacher who'd been hesitant herself, now she was encouraging Renee, who over time became integral to the protests. For Renee and Patricia, the book ban unlocked something inside them. But there was another Central York student who already had that activist streak, who was already an outspoken kid. The book ban led him to reckon with something more personal. There's this idea that the best way to pique a kid's interest in a book is to ban it. That's exactly what happened with Eli Holland Garcia.
The funny thing is, all of those people were like, we need to keep the kids away from reading this, prevent them from seeing it at all costs. Yet them doing that is exactly what brought it to my attention to read it.
Eli had tuned into a school board meeting where people were railing against one particular book, All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson. It's a memoir about growing up Black and queer, and it's been challenged in school districts across the country.
The one comment that really just I couldn't get over was calling it porn when it was talking about a person's experience as a child. Like, it felt like I got punched in the chest with like a jackhammer emotionally when I watched that, because the whole point of that is to make gay people, is to sexualize them and then make them seem like less of a person.
Eli decided he wanted to speak up at the next school board meeting on behalf of himself and other LGBTQ students. But he knew that before he defended the book, he should probably read it.
Mainly just to give me background. I had no intention of it becoming very important to me in a lot of ways. I had no intention of that. It was solely just to read it to get a grasp of the information in it. But then I read it and I was like, oh, wow, this is like, it made me cry and it made me feel like I wasn't crazy with a lot of the things I experienced as a child.
Johnson wrote about getting beat up as a kid for being too feminine, something Eli also experienced. And he wrote about being sexually assaulted by an older male cousin. Remarkably, a very similar thing had happened to Eli.
And I always thought that it was my fault, that I was wrong and weird and disgusting and whatever for it.
Sometimes he'd zone out, see it happening all over again, and then ask himself why he hadn't stopped it. But reading Johnson's account of a very similar experience reframed Eli's understanding of what had happened to him.
Reading that made me really realize that it wasn't my fault and that I'm not some weird, disgusting creature like other people try to make us out to be. Now I can look at it and be like, it's not your fault. You were too young. You were too young to understand. And you were also scared because you had no representation or anything.
This wouldn't have happened if that book had never ended up on his radar.
It's really universally cosmic how them being so hateful and so outwardly just disgusting towards us and towards this book, everything, actually helped heal me. And that's, I feel like that's just something really special, kind of, is that their being so hateful helped me heal myself.
This all strengthened his resolve to speak in front of the school board. Before, he was a little on the fence.
And then once I read the book, I hopped the fence, hopped over the frickin' trench, ran through the frickin' woods onto the other side of the continent, and I was ready to go. So.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Eli Hollinger-Garcia, an 18-year-old student of Central York High School. And I want to say, first, thank you for your service to this district.
And when Eli shared his story, the response was overwhelming.
I read the book this weekend, and not only was it beautiful, it gave me an insight to my own assault that I would have never had otherwise.
The room erupted in applause. Eli knows his one speech in front of the school board doesn't change everything. People are still speaking out against certain books. But he also wants to believe people can evolve, like his grandparents, who he says used to be very conservative. Now they're really supportive.
I mean, I send them my makeup looks. My grandpa has in the past sent me makeup looks. He's like, you need to try this, you know? And so they've come such a long way. And so like, I know people can change. I just know that it also sometimes takes 60 years.
In a lot of ways, what happened in Central York is a success story. A small group of students decided to fight back against a book ban. Their movement grew, got national attention, and they won. Now they're a model for other student activists. It even led to the election of school board candidates who opposed the ban. Again, student Renee Ellis.
Coming from a Black person's perspective, you know, there's people who believe you should be dead or not in this country or inferior or enslaved. So you just have to go through that and you have to know how to best survive that. So when we came to those community protests and there was a whole bunch of people there, it was like, whoa, this is our community. That was really encouraging to see, because you have those select few that are a little scary, and then you have those people that show up and they show out and they really support students.
Renee's dad says he used to worry about her because she was so shy. But over the past year, he's watched her blossom. that quiet girl, is now the director of communications and outreach for the Panther Anti-Racist Union. When she gets to college, she wants to minor in political science so she can continue her activism. But the move to censor books hasn't stopped. Teacher Patricia Jackson says both she and her mom received threats after she started speaking out. And for some, it's hard to unsee the side of the community that this fight exposed. That brings us back to Erica, the mom you heard at the beginning of the story. Yes, the board lifted that freeze on teaching materials. But the fact that they were frozen to begin with, Erica says it confirmed something she hadn't wanted to admit.
You know what the book ban really, really did? All of that, like, it's not racism, it's something else. It's a bad day. The book ban made it like, oh no, that is what it was all that time.
It's changed how she views some of what she and her kids have experienced in New York. She's relitigating all of these past moments. And now when something feels off, she wonders if it has to do with race. Like recently, when she says her older daughter texted from school to say she'd been told to cover up.
It's warm outside. She has on a crop top, which all of the girls are wearing. But why, you know? So before the ban, I don't know if I would have just put race pop right in my mind when she sent it to me. But of course, race pops right into my mind.
Whether race is at play or not, it's exhausting to always have that seed of doubt. All this has made Erica wonder if her family should stay in Central York. She moved here because it seemed like one of the better places to raise her kids.
Does better equal white? And it shouldn't be like that. Better should just be better. So it was like, I want it better for my kids. So we moved out here. But my daughter doesn't have any friends that look like her. All of her friends are beautiful little white girls. And she's the only beautiful little black girl. And it's hard. It's hard for her to identify if all of the books in her school look like all of her friends and none of the books in her school look like her. It's hard. It's just... yeah, tough.
Students like Renee Ellis are working hard to make sure that won't be the case. At a Panther Anti-Racist Union meeting this spring, she pointed to a table piled high with picture books, with stories about a Mexican family making tamales for Christmas and a black family passing down musical traditions. Renee explains they're headed for a community bookshelf.
And so we actually purchased books to donate to their bookshelf. And so we would love it if you guys could sign the books, put like inspirational messages to the kids, put like the Paru stickers on there, just as a way for us to like reach out to the community, right? To do something good for the children. And I think
the students grab Sharpies and get to work. You're amazing, they write. Keep dreaming.
Schooled is produced by WHYY in Philadelphia. This episode was written by Mallory Falk. It was edited by me, Avi Wolfman Arendt, with help from Emily Rizzo. Engineer Mike Villers helped mix the sound. WHYY's Vice President of News is John Massoni. For more info on this episode, including pictures, visit whyy.org/schooled. Next week, in part two, we travel to Central Bucks in the Philadelphia suburbs. A different fight over books and representation with a very different outcome. Stay tuned.